For What's Universal Time, stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. British leaders are attempting to reassure financial markets following last week's referendum to leave the European Union. Finance Minister George Osborne is to deliver a statement later Monday. Speaking Sunday at the Aspen Ideas Festival in Colorado, International Monetary Fund Managing Director Christine Lagarde said even though the referendum outcome was vastly underestimated by markets, there was no panic.
Central bankers did their job. All groupings, organizations, eminent policymakers came out publicly along the same lines of trying to reassure that the situation was under control, and it was very much under control. We didn't see those sort of panic moves.
Meanwhile, the political fallout from the EU referendum continues with demands that Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn step down and Scottish officials who wish to remain in the EU consider another independence referendum. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry in Rome Sunday travels to London and Brussels, the first American official to do so since the so-called Brexit vote.
I am absolutely convinced, President Obama is absolutely convinced, that we will be able to work through this in a sensible, thoughtful way that takes the best strengths of the EU, the best strengths of the marketplace, the best interests of our national security and international security, and works to keep them moving in the right direction for our countries.
Friday, President Obama said the United Kingdom and the EU will both remain indispensable partners of the U.S. Seven people, including four Australians, a New Zealander, and a South African, were freed Sunday, 4 days after being kidnapped in southeast Nigeria. They are said to be in good condition, no ransom paid. This is VOA News. Iraqi forces recaptured the last neighborhood of Fallujah, ending a month-long offensive to wrest the key city from its Islamic State defenders. The Jolan district was liberated Sunday, the victory part of an overall campaign to defeat the IS insurgency, which seized large parts of Syria and Iraq in 2014. Israel and Turkey Sunday reached agreement to normalize relations that would end a six-year rift caused by a raid by Israeli commandos that killed 10 pro-Palestinian activists on board a Turkish vessel trying to break an Israeli naval blockade of the Gaza Strip. Joseph Olmert, a regional analyst at the University of South Carolina, says he sees it as a victory for Israel.
Altogether, I think that this is another indication that Israel is not isolated in the Middle East, that Israel is indeed a country that other states and countries would like to be in on friendly relations with.
A formal announcement is expected from both sides Monday. The two countries have engaged in talks since 2013. Among the provisions of the deal, Israel agrees to pay $20 million in compensation to families of those killed and wounded in the raid. In Yemen, fighting between government forces and Shia Houthi rebels raged Sunday on several fronts, killing more than 40. Clashes were reported in the provinces of Taiz, Beta, and Marib. The fighting comes as UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon arrived in Kuwait to meet representatives of both sides to push forward peace talks that have made little progress over the past 2 months. Tunisia Sunday observed a moment of silence marking the one-year anniversary of a seaside attack claimed by Islamic State that killed nearly 40 tourists, most of them British. Diplomats from across Europe attended the ceremony at the Marhaba Hotel near Sousse. At least 10 people were wounded, too critically Sunday, when counter-protesters clashed with neo-Nazis in the California state capital, Sacramento. Highway Patrol spokesman George Granada said a series of fights broke out. The capital area was locked down until protesters were cleared.
We were supposed to have a permitted event that was the party that had the permit is traditional workers' party. That event was supposed to take place at 12 o'clock West Coast time on the west side of the state capitol. So prior to that event, you had a anti-fascist group show up to do an anti-protest of this event.
The melee followed by 4 months another clash involving members of the Ku Klux Klan and counter-protesters in Anaheim, California. Panama Sunday officially opened an addition to its fabled sea canal for a new generation of supercargo ships following a 9-year, $5.4 billion expansion that will double shipping capacity and impact global trade routes. The Chinese flag container ship Costco Shipping Panama made its way through a string of locks on the 77-kilometer Isthmus of Panama. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, in for James Batty. Today is Monday, June 27th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you. U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama will be in Liberia to highlight the importance of girls' education.
She is going to go to a place called Kakata. Kakata, about 45 miles from Monrovia itself, where the U.S. Peace Corps has its training and programming facilities.
VOA reporter James Batty speaking with me from Liberia, where he's covering the visit of U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama. Iraqi senior officials say that their forces have liberated the city of Fallujah from the Islamic State fighters following a month-long military offensive to seize control of the city. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry will make previously unannounced stops in Brussels and London today as Washington reacts with concern to Britain's vote to pull out of the European Union. And the seventh edition of the Global Entrepreneurship Summit concluded this weekend in Palo Alto, California.
We had entrepreneurs from every corner of the earth in a situation where they were able to meet one another, speak to one another, hear each other's ideas, but more importantly, mixed with venture capitalists and organizations that have the power to take their startups from idea to successful businesses.
Nosa Garrick is a filmmaker who tells the stories of young African entrepreneurs and innovators on her documentary series, My Africa Is. Those stories, plus Mark Owuma's sports, are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. The U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama will be in Liberia today on a visit where she plans to highlight girls' education. VOA's James Batty is on assignment in the Liberian capital, Monrovia, where he's covering the visit. He joins us live via telephone link. James, you're in Liberia, in Monrovia, today in preparation for the visit of the U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama. What is the mood like in Liberia? Are Liberians ready for Michelle Obama's visit?
Yes, Jackson. As you know, First Lady Michelle Obama comes to Liberia today, Monday. And Liberians have been kind of looking forward to Mrs. Obama's visit with great anticipation. And they are eagerly awaiting her arrival, which is today, Monday, in Liberia. But in the capital city itself, Monrovia, where I am based, the media particularly, and let me tell you that they have a proliferation of lots of radio stations and newspapers, and the media have been talking about her coming, and so people are looking forward to that. Unfortunately, though, for a great majority of the people in the Monrovia Center itself, they may not get to see Mrs. Obama in person because she is not coming. She is not coming through to the city center. She might just arrive and go to a couple of places outside the capital city.
Okay. You say she's actually not going to visit the capital city, Monrovia. But how long is she in the country, and which cities is she going to visit while in Liberia?
We are told that the First Lady has about maybe 5 to 6 hours to stay in Liberia, and that's one of the reasons that she does not have the time. Although the Liberian government had wanted for her to come to the city itself, come to Monrovia City itself, but she does not, according to what we understand, have enough time. As a result, she is not coming to Monrovia City Center itself.
And where is she actually going to visit? If she's not going to Monrovia, which cities is she going to visit?
She is going to go to a place called Kakata. Kakata, about 45 miles from Monrovia itself, where the U.S. Peace Corps has its training and programming facilities. This is where when Peace Corps come to the country, this is where they are trained because they have to understand culture and kind of people that they are going to be dealing with. This is where they are trained. And she goes to Kakata. From Kakata, Mrs. Obama will return to Unification Town, which is nearer to the Roberts International Airport, where she will visit a school called the R.S. Caulfield High School.
Why is she visiting the school? What is the purpose of her visit to that school?
What we understand is the purpose of the First Lady's visit to Liberia. This is part of the Let Girls Learn initiative. This was started in 2015 by President Barack Obama and Mrs. Obama as part of the U.S. government effort to, what they say, address some of the challenges that are preventing millions of young girls, adolescents, from attending and completing their school. The U.S. Peace Corps is really involved in this particular program and has funded more than 100 Let Girls Learn projects. So that's the connection of the Peace Corps, 100 Let Girls Learn projects in about 21 countries in Africa. During her visit, Mrs. Obama will visit the school that I told you about in Unification Town, and where she will hold discussions with these adolescent girls who have faced some serious obstacles in getting their education.
Do you know if she's going to meet with the president, Sirleaf Johnson?
Oh, yes. President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf is going to be at the airport and will be traveling with the U.S. First Lady.
Okay. Are there any special activities that you know of in the city that are being organized in commemoration of her visit?
Well, because she is not coming to the city center itself, but people do know that she's coming. And as we were saying, she goes to Calcutta, where the Peace Corps has, the U.S. Peace Corps has its training and programming facility. And on Saturday, I traveled to Calcutta, where I talked with Becky Banton. Becky Banton is the director of the U.S. Peace Corps training and programming facility.
Next, let's listen to the interview that you had with Missy Becky Banton.
Let Girls Learn is an initiative started by Michelle Obama to encourage the 62 million girls who are out of school to be able to access education.
And what is the Peace Corps' role in this?
So Peace Corps' role, we have, I think, 26 countries that are involved in Let Girls Learn, and our goal is to, in Liberia specifically, our goal is to encourage education both among girls and boys, but increasing the access of education to girls.
Now, the First Lady will be coming to Calcutta, we understand, to meet with some young women who are involved in your program, something called GLOW. What is it?
So GLOW stands for Girls Leading Our World, and GLOW has been happening for many years in different Peace Corps countries all around the world. And so it's a camp where you talk about leadership and self-esteem and healthy relationships, and just giving girls kind of tools they need and leadership skills to kind of make good decisions for their lives.
So what do you see as some of the impediments for girls' education here in Liberia?
I mean, I think other people can answer that better, but I think many times it's socioeconomic, where maybe they don't have money for school fees. Many times girls and boys actually have to work in order to help their families, provide food for their families. And so there's many different reasons why girls aren't in school.
So this is the Peace Corps training facility.
Yes.
What exactly do you do here?
So when we currently have trainees here, and so we train them to be Peace Corps volunteers in Liberia. So they are all math and science teachers at the high school level in government high schools. And so we are training them to be volunteers, to be teachers, so they can go out into Liberian schools and teach Liberian students effectively.
As a Peace Corps in Africa, in Liberia, when you go back home, what do Americans ask you about what Liberia is and what Africa is?
So I think there is this single story about what Africa is, that it's this, that it's all the same. And of course, there's many variations within this country, much less around the continent. And so I just try to explain when the tiny part of Africa that I live in now is very different among the country. And so I just try to tell them that it's not just one place and then everyone's different. I think there's a lot of misunderstandings of what people have of Africans. And, you know, many times what they see on TV is not what really happens here day to day.
So you kind of feel there's the need for Peace Corps like you to come to Africa, more Peace Corps.
Well, I mean, I think Peace Corps is a greater organization,
yeah.
And I think volunteers do make a positive impact in the communities they work with, as well as grow themselves. So I think that's a really positive thing. And I don't know about, I mean, more Peace Corps is great. So people should join, and it's a great experience and life-changing.
Making the world a different place.
Well, we hope.
Becky, I have one last question.
Okay.
Have you learned to eat Liberian food, or have you learned to prepare Liberian food? And what's your favorite?
So I haven't learned to prepare, but I can eat a small, but I can't eat rice.
You see, I like it. Small.
Small. But I can't eat rice every day. So, but my favorite is I like potato greens. I like ground pea.
Well, I like to introduce you to cassava leaves, okay?
Thank you very much.
Okay.
That was Becky Banton, Director of Programming of the U.S. Peace Corps Programming and Training Facility in Calcutta, just 45 miles outside of Monrovia. I had a chance to, I spoke with her on Saturday ahead of the First Lady Michelle Obama's visit. As you know, Mrs. Obama will be visiting Calcutta at that particular facility when she arrives today, Monday.
Thank you very much, James Batty. James is in Liberia covering the visit of the U.S. First Lady Michelle Obama. Thank you very much, James. We look forward to talking to you tomorrow.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Jackson.
That was VOA's James Batty. He joined us live from the Liberian capital, Monrovia. Authorities in Somalia say a terrorist siege of a Mogadishu hotel this weekend ended, but not before at least 20 people were killed, including a government minister. The militant group Al-Shabaab is claiming responsibility for the attack, saying the hotel is frequented by what it calls apostate government members. Somalia's foreign minister says among the dead is the country's environment minister, Buri Mohamed Hamza. Over the past years, the Islamist group has been targeting big hotels and the most populated places in the capital of Mogadishu. Professor William Reno is a researcher in the Department of Political Science at Northwest University in Chicago. He tells VOA Somali Services' Sarah Abdi Ahmed that with such attacks, Al-Shabaab is sending a signal that they are still able to carry out deadly assaults in the city.
They have guards and so forth, but they're vulnerable because, you know, the legislators who live inside them and other people and the bombers want to target them. So the hotels, of course, are a good target.
And who's the responsibility to prevent such attacks that are going to the hotels?
Well, ideally, it's the government of Somalia's job to do that, but I think that one of the problems that I've seen from reports is that sometimes the security forces might be giving information to the people who do the attacks. So one way to tell might be if the police run away before an attack or something like that. But, of course, we see both happen. Sometimes the security forces are there and they fight back, but then there are other security forces that might share information with the attackers.
Al-Shabaab has been carrying such attacks over the last 5 years, and their attacks were going to the most populated places like the hotels, the airport, you know, places that are most of the people staying. So as long as they are not controlling the bigger cities, the bigger regions of South and Central Somalia, does these attacks mean they're getting or regaining their power, or they're just doing like hit-and-run attacks?
Well, attacks like this are a way of communicating to other people. So what the attacks tell people is that even if Al-Shabaab doesn't actually rule Mogadishu, that it operates, it can control places, it can strike at any time. There are people who know that Shabaab is there. You know, so everybody else who's looking at the situation has to wonder, how extensive is this Shabaab control? And, you know, to attack these hotels, to kill legislators, other government officials and people, it's a sign to people in the city that they should not be able to rely on their government or to AMISOM to be able to protect them. The bombings can tell people that there are two powers in the city. There is the government, but there's also Al-Shabaab.
The 7th edition of the Global Entrepreneurship Summit concluded this past weekend at Stanford University in Palo Alto, California. U.S. President Barack Obama urged young entrepreneurs, including many from Africa, to expand and broaden the benefits of the world's interconnected nature. Nosa Garrick is a filmmaker who tells the stories of young African entrepreneurs and innovators on her documentary series, My Africa Is. She was in Palo Alto at the Global Entrepreneurship Summit, where she met with young African entrepreneurs, many of whom are starting and running businesses across the continent. I reached Nosa by phone in Washington, D.C.
Well, I was really pleased to meet a lot of the African startups or African-led startups at the summit. Right before the summit, we had the big news with Andela being funded by Mark Zuckerberg's foundation. And it points to the resilience, it points to the connectedness, and it points to the fact that these companies are viable and do stand a chance at being successful. A lot of the entrepreneurs I met were forward-thinking, so we're not just talking about low-tech, we're talking about high-tech. I had the pleasure of meeting one South African entrepreneur who was making 3D-printed prosthetics. You know, other people that were creating global marketplaces for goods and services that people in rural areas may not have access to, as well as making African goods available around the world. So there is they're engaged. You know, African entrepreneurs are engaged. They're actually some of the most resilient entrepreneurs. They're most likely to start businesses. They probably have the most innate sense of entrepreneurship and innovation, because as we know, entrepreneurship and innovation comes from a place of not having. And a lot of the businesses that are coming out of the continent are about fulfilling major infrastructural needs that are missing. And what they're creating are means to leapfrog those some of the infrastructure that they don't have access to, and actually creating models that affect the world globally. So even if we look at mobile money, that's something that was originated and pioneered and developed in Kenya. And that is a conversation that we're starting to have around financial technology and how big of a player that is in this global economy. So, you know, a lot of people don't realize it, but I definitely don't think that entrepreneurs from the African continent should be underestimated. And the hope is that once people get a better understanding and start becoming more familiar with entrepreneurship on the continent, there will be more access.
Right, and you did speak to the resilience that these young people have in the face of many obstacles. Why don't you talk to us about some of the challenges that they told you they face as they start businesses or run their businesses?
I mean, the two biggest challenges that I've heard from companies on the continent is one, funding. And that comes with, you know, access to capital, access to people who have capital. And I think that's one of the biggest problems, which stems from A, them not knowing the individuals that they can go to with money. You know, the African rich don't make up that much of a percentage of the population. So it's about who you know, and that's the case everywhere. Secondly, it's about familiarity, which, as one entrepreneur told me, with businesses on the continent or with the continent in general. So even if you have outside investors that may be interested in or think that their solution is brilliant or whatever product they're offering, but because they're not familiar, and there's also this perception that businesses may not do well from the continent, so they're not likely to invest. The second biggest challenge they have is access to human capital. You know, it's one thing to start a team and to create a startup as a solopreneur or solo entrepreneur, but that's not necessarily something that's sustainable. And so finding the human capital, individuals that you can make a part of your team and can grow out your business more efficiently, something that they may not have access to because some people may not have the skills and also the experience.
Tell us a little bit about My Africa Is and what you see your role as a storyteller in terms of telling the stories of these young entrepreneurs on the continent.
As far as my role, I see myself as a catalyst. I see myself as someone that is able to give platforms to folks who have not had exposure yet, which is why I try to dig really deep for stories that have not been told on the more mainstream media side of things. Because, you know, again, pointing back to that lack of familiarity, also it's painting the continent as more than just a victim mentality where we just are a place that needs to be aided. I want to point to these individuals that have solutions.
Nosa Garrick is a Nigerian filmmaker who tells the stories of young African entrepreneurs and innovators on her documentary series, My Africa Is. And now time for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here's Mark Owuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Good morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, Jackson. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin at the Africa Senior Athletics Championships in Eteguini, South Africa. South African Wade Fanica clocked 20.02 seconds to triumph in men's 200 meters on Sunday. Ivory Coast's Jose Barry Talou won women's 200 meters in 22.81 seconds. Morocco's Fouad El Kam and Kenyan Douglas Kipserem carried the day in the men's 1500 meters and 5000 meters, respectively. South Africa's Caster Semenya and Wenda Nell, along with Kenyan Nora Jeruto, won gold medals in women's 1500 meters, 400 meter hurdles, and 3000 meter steeplechase, respectively. On the infield, Lisa Labiche of the Seychelles, Cameroon's Aureole Dongmo, and Ghana's Nadia Eke triumphed in women's high jump, shot put, and triple jump, respectively, as South African Filmar van Rensburg won men's javelin. Kenyans Samuel Gathimba and Grace Wanjiru prevailed in men's and women's 20-kilometer race walking, respectively. Botswana won the men's 4x400-meter relay, with Kenya placed runners-up ahead of South Africa, while South Africa prevailed in the women's 4x400-meters ahead of Nigeria, then Kenya. At the end of the five-day contest, defending champions South Africa topped the medal table, having amassed 16 gold, 9 silver and 8 bronze medals. Kenya is second and Nigeria third. They are followed by Ivory Coast, Botswana, while Ghana and Tunisia share sixth place. Ethiopia is eighth. Morocco and Cameroon share ninth spot. Turning to football, South Africa edged Botswana 3-2 to lift the Council of Southern Africa Football Association's COSAFA Cup in Windhoek, Namibia on Saturday. Earlier on, Swaziland pipped the Democratic Republic of Congo 1-0 in the bronze medal playoff as Namibia edged Zambia 1-0 to earn the plate trophy. Swaziland's Felix Badenhorst is the tournament's top scorer with 5 goals to his credit. Meanwhile, African champions Ivory Coast are drawn in Group C with Gabon, Mali and Morocco in the Africa qualifiers for the 2018 FIFA World Cup. According to the draws conducted in Cairo, Egypt on Friday, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Guinea, Libya, and Tunisia are in Group A. Algeria, Cameroon, Nigeria, and Zambia are in Group B. Group D consists of Burkina Faso, Cape Verde Islands, Senegal, and South Africa, while Group E features Republic of Congo, Egypt, Ghana, and Uganda. The contest starts in October. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Eteguini, South Africa. Back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark, and have a good day. And that's it for this Monday, June 27th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and James Barty, as well as sports editor Mark Owuma, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington saying, have a nice day, Africa.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the 18-year-old prison sentence given to former Congolese Vice President Jean-Pierre Bemba by the International Criminal Court for rape and murder in the Central African Republic. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
For in-depth news and analysis on events in South Sudan, tune in to South Sudan in Focus, Monday through Friday from 1630 to 1700 UTC.